Hi, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Work With Purpose, a podcast about the Australian public service. My name's David Pembroke. Thanks for joining me. Today, the third in our 2020 retrospective of the Work With Purpose series. This week, we're replaying our podcast with the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, also known as ACIAR. This was an incredible episode because it introduced to me a side of the APS that I honestly didn't know that much about. ACIAR is one of the little-known agencies in the APS, but the work they do is simply incredible and giving us just such a foundation for why the Work With Purpose series is so important, because it does shine a light on the great work that is done in the Australian Public Service. Now, ACIAR, when they're not developing climate-smart livestock systems and helping farmers know when to plant crops, they're helping to build fish ladders in the Mekong River that help feed millions of people. In this podcast, you'll hear from the CEO of ACIAR, Andrew Campbell, along with his incredible team. So it is a great podcast. I commend you to it. So please enjoy some inspiring stories about the APS in what is a must-listen program. So I'll get my introduction out of the way and I'll hand it over now to the CEO of ACIAR, Andrew Campbell.
Good morning, everyone. It's fantastic here. My name's Andrew Campbell. I'm the Chief Executive of ACIAR, the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. And today I think this suits the Work With Purpose theme of the IPA podcast series extremely well, because we're talking about an agency that many of people may not have heard of, ACIAR, that's doing amazing work with purpose, primarily across our region, the Indo-Pacific region, to help low and middle income countries in our region improve their food security, their food system resilience. I'm joined today by three of the research program managers in ACIAR, Dr. Robin Johnson, who looks after our water programs, Dr. Anna O'Kello, who looks after our livestock programs, and Dr. Anne Fleming, who looks after our fisheries program. We have 10 programs, so there's just three of our RPMs here today. But we hope we can give you an insight into some of the amazing work that Australian scientists are doing in our region, sharing Australian expertise in partnership with in-country partners. And, of course, this is very challenging work at the best of times. We've been operating since 1982, and our scientists have been doing amazing work across the region. And now we find ourselves disrupted as never before with, obviously, the COVID-19 pandemic. And given that our work involves an enormous amount of travel, we've had to respond radically across all our programs, and we'll touch on those responses as the discussion goes. But first I might get Anna to talk about how COVID-19 arose essentially as an issue in food systems as a zoonotic disease, and what that means for how we're operating, but also how we might need to reform our programs in future.
Thanks, Andrew. So for sure, COVID-19 is an example of a zoonotic disease that what we call it spills over from animal reservoirs into humans. COVID is not the first disease, even in the 21st century, for this to have happened. Many people may have remembered the SARS pandemic back in the early 2000s was another example of a coronavirus similar to COVID-19 where this has happened before and spilled over. So I think the really interesting thing here is that our agri-food systems are the interface between human health and agriculture, and ACIAR has been doing a lot of work for many years looking at the interface of these two systems. And I guess people always think, well, obviously things that we grow and food that we eat has an impact on human health. Many people may not realise the number of what we call foodborne diseases or zoonotic diseases that come from animals that are also really important, and things that ACIAR has to think about when we design some of our research programs. So for the ACIAR has always funded quite a lot of research research in food safety. For example, we've been working with the International Livestock Research Institute for over 10 years now, looking at food systems research in Vietnam, and trying to work out what are really the risks, not just from a biophysical perspective in terms of, you know, diseases spilling over, but if we do things to make interventions in these food systems to make them safer, what are the impacts on not just the people that eat the food, but also the people that whose livelihoods depend on selling that food and growing that food. So we've been working in the pork system there.
So, Anna, what sort of things are Australian scientists doing with partners overseas to try and prevent future zoonotic diseases?
So we've got a really interesting program that is co-funded between ACR and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade's Indo-Pacific Centre for Health Security, which is really a One Health research program where we're working with a number of partners in Australia, including Menzies, the Burnett Institute, CSIRO, and Nossal Institute out of University of Melbourne. And these scientists are working in partnership with researchers in Indonesia, Fiji, Cambodia, Laos, a number of countries to really look at some of these, you know, big One Health issues. So, for example, antimicrobial resistance in Fiji. There's a great partnership going on there between CSIRO and the Fiji Ministry of Health and Agriculture to look at the risk of diseases coming from pathogens in those food systems. Nossal Institute, for example, is working with the Cambodian government, looking at how do we really strengthen the veterinary systems in countries like Cambodia and Laos, because without strong veterinary systems, the human health system can also not be strong if we don't know where these diseases are coming from. And the Menzies Institute is working with the Indonesian government to really look at zoonotic malaria, which is a new emerging problem in Indonesia. So I think these are all examples of ways in which Australian researchers are working on more of the preventative side of things, looking at the health system strengthening in these countries, which strong systems overseas also means strong systems back here in Australia.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. We fund Australian scientists to work in partnership with scientists from our countries in the region, in the Pacific, and our near neighbours. But many times they learn things in those projects that then have benefit back here in Australia. One of the areas where that's happening, certainly, and is around fish ladders, where we've taken science that that was being applied here in the Murray-Darling Basin and then developed it in much more challenging context in the Mekong. Do you want to talk about the fish ladder work in Laos?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Yes, it's one of the significant projects in my program. As most people would know, in the Mekong, it's a massive, one of the most significant rivers in the world, and the diversity and volume of fish that supplies poor people across Southeast Asia is incredible, and not only for food security, but also for income.
I think some of those countries, 60% of all protein consumed by people is fish out of the river.
Exactly, exactly. We're just starting to learn about the importance of fish as nutrition and moving towards eating more fish, but these countries, they've been eating fish for hundreds of years and very much depend on it as their major source of protein.
So what happens to those fish when you stick a big dam in the middle of the river?
Well, dams are great for, and yes, we're working on huge hydroelectric dams that have been established in the Mekong, 10 for Laos, 2 already established. But there's also the small low-level dams, just 3 metres high. They're the weirs, the floodgates, the regulators that are positioned to control the movement of water from the Mekong through the tributaries into the wetlands. And so both types of barriers stop fish from migrating, which means that they can't get to their breeding grounds, which means that the regulators are great for controlling rice production, but there's this impact that's now being realised that this highly important source of protein is being compromised.
Mm. And so the Australian scientists are working on fish ladders to help the fish swim upstream past the dams,
yep,
and also to get back down. through the dam both without getting squashed.
They have to move both ways. And so what is really exciting is that we're using the knowledge that we've developed in Australia, working on the Murray-Darling Basin, and applying that knowledge, that technology, to help our partners overcome this problem. So it's both fish ladders, which actually allow fish to navigate through upstream, but also the putting in mechanisms to allow them to migrate downstream as well through the floodgate systems.
We were lucky enough last year to visit the one on the Xiaoburi Dam in Laos on the Mekong, and literally hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent building the biggest fish ladder in the world. And to give people an idea of the size, there's more concrete in the fish ladder than there is in the MCG. So this is a very large engineering structure. And we've had to invent new methods to detect how the fish are, whether they're going past or not, with electronic tags and other things.
Yeah, it's an exciting piece of work. The size of that dam, as you and I saw, it's hard to fathom. And the size of this fish ladder is incredible. And the challenge is that our commissioned organisation, Charles Sturt University, has developed or is developing totally new techniques to tag fish in the Mekong, and this is different size fish from huge, potentially half ton right down to 10 centimetres. And even that, how to tag fish of diverse sizes and species and then place them upstream, and then how to set up the technologies within that massive fish ladder to pick up the movement and then assess how effective that fish ladder is in allowing fish to reach their breeding grounds.
It struck me when we were there that Professor Lee Baumgartner from Charles Sturt Uni, who's probably reasonably well known in Wagga but not a household name across Australia, is actually doing incredibly important work overseas that will make an amazing contribution in those countries if it's successful.
Yes, and his team and himself, they've got they're in hot demand across Southeast Asia, Africa, Indonesia, and he's an incredible scientist, not only for his technical expertise but his ability to work with our partners, which is a key skill in itself.
Which reminds me of another one, in fact, invented here in Canberra. We have a gizmo called the chameleon for measuring how much water is in the soil. Robin, do you want to talk a bit about that and how it's being applied in Africa and potentially soon closer to home?
Thanks, Andrew. So Australia, as you know, is water management is becoming more and more important. Australia is moving very much to precision agriculture approaches where we monitor and measure very carefully the amount of water that goes on in irrigation. But those sorts of technologies are quite expensive and haven't really been available in the developing world. So Richard Sturzaker from CSIRO in Canberra has been working on simple, low-cost approaches for farmers in the developing world to measure and monitor the amount of water and nutrients that they put onto their crop during irrigation. And he's using a system which reads out as coloured lights so that the farmers get an immediate feedback in terms that are meaningful for them of what the water status is. So a red light tells them their soil is very dry and needs watering. Green, it's moving into a drier phase. Blue, no need to water. And so Richard's been working very much along the lines of working with farmers to learn about how to use water most effectively. And the wonderful thing about it is that the savings in water not only benefit the farmer and the environment, but they also translate to savings in labour. If you've got to water less often, then you've got more time to do other things on the farm or for other income-generating activities.
So this is an example where Australia, operating in a very dry but extremely variable climate, has had to develop agricultural technologies for managing that variable climate that are now in much more demand overseas as other countries find that their own seasons are becoming less predictable and more extreme. Do you want to talk more broadly about irrigation schemes and some of our water basin management work that where Australian science is helping, say, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh and also the Mekong countries?
So one of the other areas we're working in is the Eastern Gangetic Plain, the area where India, Bangladesh and Nepal come together, which is one of the most densely populated agricultural areas in the world. And under, because it's a low-lying delta area, under increasing threat from climate change. So food security there is an enormous issue, and we've been working in that area around the questions. It's because it's a monsoonal area, there's abundant water during the wet season, and water is much harder to come by during the dry season. So we've been working across a range of scales on approaches to allow farmers to get a second or a third crop to increase food availability. So at the farm level, we've been taking the sorts of approaches that Australia's been developing over the last 50 years for conservation agriculture, which both increases productivity, reduces inputs and saves water. And at the bigger scale, we've been looking, using Australia's expertise in surface water and groundwater conjunctive management to look at how groundwater plays into water availability in that area. And then CSIRO's been translating our experience with basin scale management to look at how water can be shared across countries and across sectors.
So in essence, our scientific expertise and the depth of our expertise in food production, but also in managing challenging environments, is a strategic asset for Australia as we interact with our partner countries across the region, because they're all facing similar challenges of how we continue to produce food more sustainably in more difficult environments.
Yeah, very much so. I think two of the advantages Australia has. One is that we're used to working in water-scarce environments, but the other, oddly, is that we're used to working in data-scarce environments. So a lot of the expertise that would come in from Europe or America, they're used to having much more abundant information, whereas Australian science has got very good at making the best of a limited set of information and being able to use that most productively.
And also in Europe, the US, Japan, there's a much higher level of agricultural subsidies, which means that farmers have more money. And again, in Australia, perversely, it's an asset for us that our agriculture is not subsidised. And so we've had to come up with miserly ways of improving the system that farmers can afford to implement without subsidies.
Yeah, and those low input systems are very important in the developing world.
And many of our listeners may not realise, but a big proportion of the world's food is actually grown by smallholder farmers, 500 million smallholder farmers, who themselves are among the poorest people in the world, some of them actually landless. And so a big part of our work is working with the poorest of the poor to help them produce more food for themselves as well as for their communities, and to manage their animals and their resources in the best way possible. Anna, do you want to talk about some of the animal health work, small-scale animal health work that your program has been doing, and the way that feeds into biosecurity and risks to humans?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think maybe some things that many people may not realise around livestock when they think of livestock in a high-income country scenario is that livestock in low-middle-income country settings actually play a large range of roles. Yes, it's a contribution to food and food security, particularly through meat, milk, eggs. But livestock are actually, they act as a bank for people. They're their social security. If people need to, pay for hospital fees, dairies, for example, they'll sell a pig. Livestock are really liquefiable assets. So a lot of the work that we do in the livestock program is not just around how do we produce more livestock, but really trying to recognise the really diverse role of livestock in and these sort of livelihoods.
Cultural as well.
And cultural as well, you know. So I think it's been really interesting. There's been a disease spreading through Asia, region called African swine fever, the last bit more than a year, where we've been dealing with governments in a lot of our partner countries how to manage this disease. It's a disease of pigs. It kills the pigs outright. There's no vaccine for it at the moment. So really a large amount of the protein through people eating pork has dropped out of the system in countries like Vietnam, China, Laos, Myanmar. And then closer to home in countries like Timor-Leste and Papua New Guinea, where people may not necessarily eat pigs, but they're really valuable culturally. Really, how do we capture all the different impacts of a disease like African swine fever, not just in terms of food security, people not having that pork to eat, but, you know, someone not having the money or the gift when someone dies, for example, to give at the funeral, or when their child has to go to school, you know. So when you have livestock disease, you see a lot of sort of multiplier effects on the communities. Weddings don't happen, for example. Kids can't go to school. People can't pay for their out-of-pocket healthcare costs. So, a lot of the research we're doing around African swine fever, for example, is more about not just necessarily how do we control the disease and biosecurity messaging and all that sort of thing, but what is the impact on the livelihoods that this is having.
On biosecurity, there are a number of APS agencies who work on biosecurity, particularly at the border. Would you like to comment on how our work pre-border helps Australia's biosecurity?
Absolutely. If you think of biosecurity, it's pre-border biosecurity and then border, so post border biosecurity, which is where, you know, the x-ray machines at the airports and that sort of thing. And then we have post-border, which is everything that happens inside Australia. So ACR works very much on this pre-border part of the equation. We work with the Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment. Also, they have a pre-border program and also their Northern Australian Quarantine Service. We also work with DFAT, again, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. In Timor-Leste and Papua New Guinea, we've got good examples of, you know, this sort of cross-agency collaboration where, you know, we have many meetings with DFAT and the Department of Agriculture around how do we pool our resources here in Australia to best offer the assistance to governments in Timor-Leste and Papua New Guinea. And we've been doing that with African swine fever. Fall armyworm is another example. There's different types of biosecurity issues. But I think it's a really good example of how Australian government agencies, we do talk to each other, we work together, we pool our resources and find out, okay, who's best placed to help with these things.
And in some cases, it's through ACR projects that Australian scientists get to work on diseases overseas, and we'd much prefer that they're working on them overseas than waiting until they get to Australia. So I'm a forester originally, and we have Australian foresters working on diseases of eucalypts and acacias in Vietnam, and we'd certainly prefer that they work on them there than wait till they get here. In the past, we've had Queensland scientists working on Fusarium wilt in bananas in the Philippines and elsewhere. And then, very luckily for Australia, one of those scientists spotted what he thought was the same thing on a farm in Queensland, and it turned out they were able to stop that potentially could have destroyed the Australian banana crop, but they were able to quarantine one farm and stop it in its tracks. But only because that scientist was able to recognise it very early, because they'd been working on it overseas. And I think we've had a similar story with Newcastle disease in chickens, haven't we, Anne?
Absolutely. And I think they're really good examples of how, you know, capacity building. We do a lot of capacity building in ACR, but not just in our partner countries. We also build capacity of our own researchers. And, you know, I think if COVID has shown us nothing else, diseases don't respect national boundaries. And the more we can work in partnership to address, you know, swiftly moving diseases around our region, such as African swine fever, fall armyworm, you know, both Australia benefits from that as well as our partners.
And every now and again we have a project overseas that's a bit experimental that yields potentially significant benefits for us. And I was thinking here of work in the Philippines on blast fishing, and how do you get coral reefs to come back after blast fishing that now looks like it might come back to the Great Barrier Reef. Do you want to talk about that, Anne?
Yeah, another really exciting piece of work. So blast fishing, dynamite fishing, has damaged reefs in the Philippines, plus, of course, coral bleaching, climate change impacts. And again, coral reefs support fish populations, and fish is very important for Philippine people in terms of income, for poor coastal communities, and food security. So we've got a fantastic team at Southern Cross University working on the Great Barrier Reef, and at the same time working in the Philippines on trying to develop techniques of sexual-based restoration, where the natural spawn from the coral, which I think many people would have heard how this occurs in the full moon, the first week of March, or somewhere similar, and you can collect that spawn. It's floating on the surface of the sea. You have to go out there at night. And the work is to develop the technologies to collect that at a scale that can then be used as a resource to take back down to those damaged coral reefs and then support them to grow and restore the coral reefs. So there's a whole lot of different technologies at each of those steps that the team is developing, both at the Great Barrier Reef, but that fantastic knowledge exchange and application. It actually started in the Philippines, has now been applied to Great Barrier Reef, but of course technologies are both ways now. And the interesting recent development that we'll be moving into is to hone in on those coral species that are actually heat tolerant, and so that as climate change becomes a greater problem and sea temperatures rise, we'll actually have selected the corals that will be able to better cope with those high temperatures conditions. Mm.
Yes, when we develop partnerships with our partner countries, of course, we spend a lot of time discussing with them what their priorities are. And in the 30-something countries that ACR works with, climate change is priority one, two, or three in every single country that we work in. So, Robin, I know it's no longer your area, but you might want to mention some of the work that we're doing to help countries understand their agricultural emissions and to quantify the opportunity, because although low and middle income countries, agriculture is not a huge contributor to global emissions, within those countries, usually the agriculture sector is one of their more important contributors, and they are interested in finding out where are the opportunities to benefit. And Anna, you might want to mention the work on livestock emissions and ensuring that we get more accurate data around that.
So Australia's put quite a lot of effort into systems to measure and validate greenhouse gas emissions from different land sectors. And in some of the countries we work with, although, as Andrew says, they may not be major emissions in global terms, it can still be an important pathway for support for changing systems, both to improve productivity and reduce emissions at the same time from the agricultural sector. So we've been working with initially Fiji and Vietnam through the University of Melbourne and University of Queensland to take our expertise on estimating and validating emissions from agricultural from the agricultural sector to help those countries be able to report accurately against the Paris commitments for what's called their nationally determined contributions. The point of doing that is twofold. One is that it enables them to tap into some of the global funding mechanisms to reduce their emissions, but it has a secondary but quite important benefit that it just gives them a better basis for understanding their agricultural statistics generally. So that's an interesting piece of work that's just starting to develop.
And particularly, you know, livestock are often in the gun in greenhouse gas debates, Anna, but in some cases, this is a problem of people assuming that all livestock are the same, and there's a big difference between a Kansas feedlot and a Maasai herder.
Exactly, Andrew, and this is a message that I've been, you know, me and others have been trying to portray for a long time. I mean, like Robin said, you know, agriculture is a significant contributor to emissions in many of the countries we work in. But if you break that down, livestock is usually more than 50% of those agricultural emissions. So a lot of the work that we've been trying to do in the livestock program is capture when we're trying to improve productivity of livestock from a livelihoods perspective or a food security perspective, you know, what are we trying to do? We're trying to feed them better food. We're trying to control disease so it doesn't spill over to humans. We're trying to control disease so animals can produce better. All those things, the third win of that is the potential that better fed animals, better produced animals actually emit less emissions on a per head basis. So when we say, okay, we're going to improve these systems, make them more efficient, and trying to market that, I guess, to from the greenhouse gas perspective, we need very accurate ways of measuring those emissions reductions. And like Robin said, one of the bigger problems we've got with many low-middle income countries is that the inventory systems for measuring those emissions aren't sensitive enough. And like Australia, we have a Tier 3 emissions inventory. We're using some of the people that have been developing those systems here in Australia to work with our partner countries to move them from a Tier 1 to a Tier 2 emissions inventory.
Yeah. So. This is an area where, through our Emissions Reduction Fund and the Carbon Farming Initiative, Indigenous Savannah Burning Programs, Australia is actually a world leader in managing emissions in the land sector. And in fact, next year we take on the global chair role of the Global Research Alliance on Agricultural Greenhouse Gases. And one of the reasons for that is because our science is so well recognised and well respected across the world. So this is an area where Australia is making a leading contribution across our region and helping many countries to both understand their profile, but also identify where they can profitably tackle it. And when we have industry like the Australian red meat sector setting itself a carbon neutral by 2030 target, it means that we actually have many leading producers that we can showcase the work on farm that's happening in Australia. And that's of great interest in partner countries. And again, noting that hasn't been driven by agricultural subsidies, but by farmers just wanting to produce much more efficiently. I'm going to discuss now a very high priority for the Australian aid program, and noting that my boss, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, is also the Minister for Women, and that is gender equality across all our work. And I'm going to ask each of you to talk about some of the work within your own programs that's about women's empowerment, and I'll talk more broadly about it. But Anne, would you like to talk about some of our work in the Pacific?
Yes, that came to my mind, Andrew. Thank you. Yes, we've got an interesting or long-term project to support women in the Pacific to produce pearl handicrafts. So not the round pearls that we're all used to, but what's called a marbe pearl or a half pearl that is much easier to produce. The technology is more simple, so it's much more appropriate for coastal communities, and particularly women actually farm the oysters in Tonga, Fiji, PNG. And other women or the same people in that village will then craft that into a piece of jewellery. And because of the tourism that used to go to the Pacific and hopefully will return not too far into the future, there's a really strong demand for a piece of artefact that is actually locally made and encompasses the local culture. So, and that's particularly strong in Tonga. They've got a long history of carving whalebone and wood. So actually the men are engaged in this work in Tonga, and they're producing beautiful, high quality pieces of work. Not only high quality, but also the trinket trade, which is, you know, volumes, and that will produce more benefits for more people, and particularly for people that aren't necessarily highly skilled. So that it's an opportunity that is very diverse, and particularly we've found that the benefits to women are not only that benefit through income, but the social connection and the sense of independence and pride that they can contribute to their household income or to their community as a whole for projects.
So we're not just talking about more food in people's bellies, we're talking about improving their overall livelihoods, their economic opportunities, their access to resources and decision making.
Yes, exactly. It's not only the economic benefits but also the ability to make their own decisions about their own lives, which is important to everyone.
If I can come in there. Women's empowerment is really deeply embedded in everything we do at all sorts of levels. But one of the things that I find really rewarding and important in the work we do is that we work with a lot of researchers from developing countries. And this gives us an opportunity to particularly give opportunities to women researchers who might otherwise find it quite difficult to get that next step in their national systems. So it's really great to have women PhD students, women officers from agricultural agencies who come out in the field with us. And it does allow us as well to work more deeply with the women farmers, because very often the extension systems are all about the men. By taking more women into the field, we can get a better sense of how the women are contributing there. And you know, women are basically half the agricultural workforce, so it's an important area.
And so we've developed a new program for women's leadership and management skills across the agricultural research sector. And when I say agriculture, I mean fisheries and forestry and climate and water and everything else, nutrition, called the Merrill Williams Fellowship. And our minister put out a terrific video about that only last week. And that's again, helping to develop new women leaders right across our region and building their linkages with Australia. So just to wrap up, I think we've had a few little examples of how Australia's depth and breadth of expertise in science is a terrific soft power asset for us in our relationships across the region, as many countries strive to tackle some of the same problems that we've been wrestling with in Australia over many, many years. But it's extremely rewarding work and just another example of the rich diversity of things that the APS is doing right around the world. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
So there you go. What an incredible story, the work that is done by the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, and really the impact that they are having around the world makes you so proud to be an Australian and to know that that is the contribution that our public servants are making to other parts of the world. So a fantastic example of the work that is done. This is the last in our series of 2020 retrospective, because we'll be back with some fresh content in the next couple of weeks. But if you're still on a break, I hope you're enjoying that. If you're not on a break and you're back to work, I hope you are refreshed, relaxed, and ready to go for what will be an incredibly important and I'm sure a certain to be busy 2021. So I look forward to joining you with more episodes of Work With Purpose in the weeks to come. But for the moment, it's bye for now.